the frame begins to cry. Something gets broken into the analytic session. And what we do then, and we interpret it just based on early material, what we know about the patient, some kind of reconstruction, or are we facing with a piece of reality that cannot be analyzed, just analyzed? It might be acknowledged, it might be that you have to face it in some way or other. And this is the similarity with what might happen when the fourth wall is disrupted.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years. And have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Isaac Tillum. As you will hear, Dr. Tillum is not only an analyst, but he's also an actor. And our conversation today revolves around the concept of the fourth wall, which is a concept from the world of acting. It represents the metaphoric space that actors inhabit on the stage. And Dr. Tillum relates it to the metaphoric space that is otherwise known as the analytic frame. He has this felicitous phrase that he uses to describe the frame, where what takes place there is the choreography between the internal and the external world. Dr. Tillum is a training and supervising analyst at the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research. He's on the faculty at the New York postdoctoral program. He's a former secretary of the IPA committee in the UN. He's a co-founder of the Trauma and Disaster Specialization Program at the NYU postdoctoral program. And in addition to being an actor and an analyst, for many years he served as a foreign correspondent for the cultural section of the Buenos Aires Herald. He is a past member of the editorial board of the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic. And quite playfully, he acted the role of Ferenczi in a theatrical event based on the correspondence between Freud and Ferenczi. We have a delightful conversation where we not only talk about the fourth wall and how he finds it useful, he gives some clinical examples of how it functions in his mind, but he also talks about his journey from Argentina, a very circuitous journey that ended up in New York. He's ensconced in both analytic places in Argentina and the States, and we talk about the differences and the similarities. I hope you enjoy our quite enjoyable conversation. Here's my talk with Dr. Isaac Tillum. Isaac, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you, Harvey.
Isaac, as you know, one of the themes of this podcast is psychoanalysis off the couch. And what that generally has meant is analysts describe their work taking their analytic mindset and skill set and describing how they apply it in many other venues outside the consulting room. In my conversations with analysts, I've realized that we need to expand that notion to also include how analysts in the consulting room deal with external events, often dramatic events. Obviously, COVID is the first thing that comes to mind, but it's also entails other things. It entails wartime. It entails terrorist attacks and dangers. It entails crimes. Generally, life-threatening events that affect both parties of the dyad have a special place in the analytic setting. Now, you have co-edited a book on this very subject with Adrian Harris. The book is titled Reconsidering the Movable Frame in Psychoanalysis, Its Function and Structure in Contemporary Psychoanalytic Theory, where you collect essays about this very subject, how the analytic space affects the outside and how the outside affects the analytic space. And you've written a great deal about it. And in one of your papers that I had the pleasure to read, you quote and refer Jeanine Puget, an Argentinian analyst, and you write the following about what she has said. Quote, she believes that the logic of the internal world differs from the logic of external reality. The analyst must accept the difference between them and be able to bring down walls. So instead of revisiting the past via the associative process, facing reality creates a new past based on connectivity rather than transference. And that's what I find to be an essential contribution that you and others are trying to make. Facing reality creates a new past based on connectivity rather than transference. There's much to be said about that. And the way you get there is through your work as an actor. You are both an actor and a psychoanalyst, and you take a principle of acting called the fourth wall, and you apply it to the analytic frame. Teach us, if you will. Tell us about the fourth wall, what it means in the acting world, and also how it informs for you the analytic frame.
Thank you, Harry, again. Well, yes, as an actor, one of the things you need to learn, once you are on stage, you don't want to be distracted by the audience. You want to pretend that the audience is not there. You want to pretend that there are not three walls, but four walls. So actors are instructed to focus in the back of the hall, the back of the theater, a particular area where you could divert your attention to it so you could reconstruct that fourth wall that is missing. In this way, reality does not impinge into the action, and it is as if the audience remains there sitting like witnesses to what might be going on stage. But reality is sealed off. However,
reality is what? Sorry, say it again.
Sealed off.
Oh, sealed off. Yes. Okay. Uh-huh.
Now, there are instances, as I mentioned in one of my papers, that the action on stage might be disrupted by someone suffering illness in the audience or one of the actors' faux pas. Immediately, then you sense that something has impinged into the sanctity of the scene. And I think there is something similar there in the analytic setting. We close the doors to our consulting room, we build up a fourth wall, and it's not that we ignore reality, but we assume that reality is not going to impinge on what might be going on inside. Now, as you mentioned before, reality is put on hold. The frame is established in order to manage something, which is the setting, which is the process, the therapeutic relationship. And yet, at times, the frame begins to cry. Something gets broken into the analytic session. And what we do then, and we interpret it just based on early material, what we know about the patient, some kind of reconstruction, or are we facing with a piece of reality that cannot be analyzed, just analyzed? It might be acknowledged, it might be that you have to face it in some way or other. And this is the similarity with what might happen when the fourth wall is disrupted. There is an anecdote that I think Yolanda shared with me once, that Freud, who used to see very wealthy patients sometimes in Vienna, and he was in touch with people from embassies who were bringing him newspapers that were censored. The local newspaper were censored, so he didn't know much what was going on during the Nazi era and between the wars and so on. And one day, one patient brought Freud a newspaper, and he opened the newspaper, read the front line, and Freud said, "What's going to happen to our children?" The patient, then addressed to Freud, who apparently was tearful at the moment, and the patient asked Freud, "Would you like to talk about it?" And Freud said, "No, let's go back to work." So it is as if Freud restored the missing wall and went back to work. Maybe that was his way of handling the disruption. He didn't establish what Jeanine Puget talks about, the connectivity with the patient at the moment and staying with the patient, sharing a reality with the patient that would have been that one has to put transference aside and share that moment with the patient, which is many of my examples, as I mentioned in some of my papers on my work. I had to put that on hold and talk about what was going on outside, whether it's September 11 of the massacre of the children in Newton. You know? The idea that the silence of the analyst in front of traumatic events that we share with our patient could be interpreted as a form of violence, the silence of the analyst as violence in some way.
It's violence in the, I think so, the violence in terms that it doesn't honor the common reality that the two people are sharing.
That could be aggressive in some form, no?
And certainly doesn't meet what we would now consider a standard of analysis. We would, including the example of Freud, I mean, the idea that we go back to work as if the work is other than how the patient felt about what just happened, including Freud's tears.
Right, and that's the significance of the frame, because the frame, the movable frame, means that the frame needs to somewhat shift, adapt to what might be going on. It's the moment where external reality is in contact with the internal world. It's a kind of a movable piece, flexible piece, that ultimately it's up to the analyst to restore it in some way or the other. We always go back and reflect on it or think about it together, but what is impinging on the analytic setting at that particular moment.
You know? Let me ask you, I heard you say the frame begins to cry. Did I hear you correctly?
Yes.
I'm touched by that, and I can't quite say why, but can you share with that? I've never heard those two images put together, the frame and crying.
In the introduction that in our book with Adrian Harris, we talked about the frame at times cries. It is as if the frame breaks, and there is the external reality impinges in such a way that it cannot be sustained. You know? The idea that we have established a frame that does not endure the impact of reality. So there is something that needs to be moved in both sense of the word, moving the movable frame and the move that analyst and analysand might be moved by the traumatic external reality.
Yeah. So the impact of reality challenges the metaphoric basis of the four walls being closed off. I understand.
Exactly. It breaks.
Okay.
I was once in a performance where one of the singers caught fire in a candle that was on a table. And the whole audience began to shout at the scene that, watch out, you're on fire, because she didn't realize that her hair was on fire. That's a dramatic example.
Yeah, I tend to think of the cell phone going off as breaking the frame, but yours is certainly much more.
Another one. Once a patient brought me a dog because he wanted to get rid of the dog, and the dog was roaming around my new office. I had to handle the dog. Anyway, there are dramatic moments like in Trier and others that are more simple, regular issues of daily life, that managed to break the frame to kind of charge the war.
That example of a patient bringing a dog, it seems to me that it combines both the reality and the metaphoric. Of course, you have to deal with the dog, but you also have to deal with the meaning of the gesture and all its vicissitudes of affectionate and hostile, I would think, and attachment. So it's often not so clear that it's in one category or another, no?
No, there is kind of a I like to call it a choreography between the internal world and the external world takes place at that moment. It's a very rich moment in all sense of the word. And it has also, there, my link with theater, it has a theatrical component. You know? I'm not the only one that uses theater as a metaphor. Joyce McDougall talks about the theater of the mind, theater of the body. So there is a lot of theatrics in this way of conceptualizing the work we do.
I like that image, the choreography between the internal and the external. And there's probably a sequence to it where you start with the connectivity and then you go to the metaphor.
Absolutely.
Sooner
or later, we need to restore the frame.
Right.
It's our obligation, it's our work to do now.
You know, you mentioned Yolanda Gampal, who I interviewed at a recent podcast, where she talks, as you do, and she has a chapter in your book, a fine chapter, where she talks about having conversation with people when both parties are exposed to bombings outside the office, for example. You have to talk about what that's like, and then, as you point out, you have to end up restoring the metaphoric space. And sometimes people have trouble with that. And one of the examples that I'm aware of is that when the analyst is ill, it used to be taught, sort of like Freud set up the frame, that you never deal with the reality. You never talk about what it is that you're sick with. You never talk about what it's like to be struggling with sickness. You just are silent and you supposedly deal with metaphor. Of course, what you're really doing is keeping a whole piece of life outside the office and sort of making a pseudo-analysis. But that's another subject. Can you talk a bit about cases where you have found it useful to appreciate what you're describing, the connectivity and then the metaphor?
Well, I mentioned in one of my papers on that case of the mother of young children who was extremely anxious following the massacre of children in Newton, in Connecticut, that so many children were killed.
Yes.
And she became obsessed with protecting her children. You know? She wouldn't let them go out. She would take them to school every day. She couldn't sleep. She was extremely anxious. And she felt that I couldn't help her in treatment because I couldn't help to change the reality. So what she will ask me, what can we do? What can we do? Almost like inviting me to proselytize against gun control, for gun control, to intervene in schools, to do something active. And
to solve the danger, to make the danger go away.
To help her solve the danger. So every time I address the roots of her anxiety or elements of her history that were kind of re-emerging in front of this dramatic situation, she felt kind of offended by it, as if I was ignoring the extreme reality of what the whole country was dealing with. And I was dumbfounded because I didn't know what to say. No matter what can I say to help this woman? So that's where I thought that my silence was a kind of a violence to her. So I began to talk about it, that we both share this reality, that the only thing that we could do here, that we could talk about it together because we share this. That's when things began to shift somewhat. And this is the example that we were connecting around this. And eventually the treatment continued with this choreography between external reality and internal reality. But the moment that I began to talk to her, like Janine says, we need to talk about this together. We need to think about this together, reflect about this together, she used to say, that the anxiety subsided and continued in a good direction in terms of alleviating her anxiety and being kind of restoring some trust in the analytic process, as well as trusting her children to be safe going to school. You know? It was a non-protracted process.
You shared the helplessness.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the face of external randomness and uncertainty. It would seem to me that the way you did that required you to have understood the eventual metaphoric space you were going to share, so that it was not just chatting. It was chatting, it was sharing, it was connecting on a human, vulnerable level, sure. But it seems to me that one does that differently if you have a sense that that's a prelude to something and not an end in and of itself.
Yes, I remind myself I have to wear the analytic hat always. It's like when I go to the movies, I am an analyst going to the movies, so I will interpret the film. So when I am in a situation like this, I also wear in a hat. Sometimes I put it on hold for a while, but I restore it and go back to what my job is, ultimately. You know?
Let me ask you a question. I see it a little differently, maybe. That is, I don't see you taking off your analytic hat when you're connecting with her as a human being. Maybe we have different ideas of what an analytic hat is, but it seems to me that being in connection to her at that moment is being attuned to her authentic experience as she has it available to her. And in doing so, your hope is that she will come to have more of herself available to her, so that you will segue into a different type of analytic togetherness, one that isn't so literal, but has, as you say, metaphor to it. I see them as all one thing. Yeah, and it may not be a real difference.
I didn't mean to say that was kind of two separate settings, two separate states. There is a fluidity between them. There is a transition. It's a two-way street kind of thing.
Yeah.
Back and forth.
And what they have in common is your effort to be with the person in the language they're able to be at any particular moment. And that's what drives whether you're with them in the connected way or whether you're with them in the metaphoric transference way.
Yeah, this is the logic of external reality and the logic of psychic reality.
Yeah, right. Isaac, tell us about you and your journey. There aren't that many analysts who are actors. And how did you get there? What's your journey like?
Well, just to say, I'm not a very successful actor, unfortunately. But I enjoy acting. How I get to that? Well, I always wanted to be an actor. I grew up in Argentina. The Jewish family emigrated from Europe in the 30s because they couldn't come to the States. They got visas to go to Argentina.
My from where? Sister, from where in Europe?
Poland.
Uh-huh. And what year did they get out?
In the mid-30s.
Wow. Okay.
My older sister was born in Warsaw, actually. Mm. So growing up in Argentina, in a kind of a, I had like a double academics. In the morning was popular school, regular school, official school. In the afternoon, the Jewish seminar. So we were studying all day long, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Discover movies, and that's what I learned. Different languages just by listening to the movies. I speak several languages and I thank the movies for that because I didn't read the subtitles. I was listening very carefully. And I wanted to be an actor when I would grow up, but that was not acceptable. The idea that I needed to be a doctor, not an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of one thing led to the other. I kind of gave in and I studied in Jerusalem for a year, went back to Argentina, then went back to Europe, lived in Switzerland for a while, And I decided to study philosophy and literature. And then while I was in the middle of philosophy, which I completed my studies, I studied clinical psychology. I graduated from clinical psychology. And I applied to a Guggenheim scholarship from Argentina to the States. At the moment that I was going to move to Europe, I got the scholarship. And then I changed directions, and at age 25, I arrived to the United States and got a doctoral in clinical psychology. Actually, today I just associated. Today is 49 years that I've arrived to this country.
Oh wow!
Spend more time here than
yeah. And how did you go from the clinical psychology training to analysis?
Well, actually, I studied in Argentina. When I studied psychology in Argentina, psychoanalysis was very much part of the curriculum in psychology.
Sure.
So I was reading Freud when I was 19 years old and so on, and I studied my analysis there. So I was already Freudian before arriving to the United States. And then here I did my doctoral, and then I applied to NYU postdoc, and the rest is... it's history. I did my second analysis here, which also helped me understand the cultural dimensions of doing analysis in a different country.
That was my next question, sure.
In Argentina, the analysis started with the analyst opened the door and we shake hands. Here, when I tried to shake hands, it was kind of an awkward moment.
You did something wrong, right?
Yeah, I did something wrong.
Yeah.
Here is the open the door and welcome the patient in. No handshakes, no touching.
Yeah. But the differences are more extensive than that, I imagine.
They are, of course. I did in Argentina, was in Spanish. Here, I did it in English, my analysis. So it was a translation of a translation of a translation.
You're involved in the analytic community in Argentina as well now?
Yes. Actually, I have a lot of colleagues in Argentina now. I became a member of the Argentina Psychoanalytic Association. I don't know if I mentioned to you that a group of us study the letters that Freud and Ferenczi exchanged, three volumes of letters. I don't know if you're aware of
them. No, I knew the letters. I didn't know your group studied them.
Yes, and we co-wrote a script on the relationship between Freud and Ferenczi based on the letters. And we performed this in many venues, in many psychoanalytic institutes in this country. We did it in Argentina, we did it in Czechoslovakia, we did it in England at the Freud Museum. We were invited to perform there. So it was a very interesting experience.
Is the script available? Can one purchase the script?
We don't have the rights yet to make it available. It's quite an interesting. I was playing Ferenczi. We did it in Philadelphia actually too, you know.
Oh no, I didn't know that.
Yeah. The psychoanalytic society there.
And so you have a foot in both worlds, the American, i.e. New York world, and the Buenos Aires world of analysis. You see a big difference in how patients are understood and intervened with, handshake aside?
There is more immediacy between patients and analysts in Argentina. That might be my...
Tell me what you mean by immediacy.
Well, people run into each other on the street more often, on the regular cafes that analysts frequent. Maybe because... after all this year, when I go to Argentina, I run into people, and it's always
right.
a delightful experience to do so. And we propose panels for IPA, for instance. An Argentinian analyst from Spain invited me for a Spanish-speaking panel that we are going to have now in 2 weeks, actually, for the IPA. I go to the meetings of FEPAL, which is the Federation of Latin American Psychologists. So, yes, I maintain a good connection with my Argentinian roots. actually.
Do you think there is more of an interest or a different kind of interest in Argentina in this concept of the movable frame? Or that's
absolutely.
Not.
I mean, I think
is that right?
They were pioneers. Don't forget that during the military dictatorship, analysis continues. And there were a lot of analysts that were quite political activists. Many were jailed, many were killed. People were running group therapy and there were undercover policemen in those groups. There was the exchange between external reality and internal reality was quite dangerous at the moment. Marie Lange has written a lot about her work. I'm sure you know Marie Lange.
And
the analytic situation. In fact, the book that I co-edited with Adrian was the idea of honoring that seminal paper by Josep Lecher, psychoanalysis of the psychoanalytic frame, which was a masterpiece, in my opinion.
Yes, and I do recommend the book. And a reference to the book will be in the podcast notes. Isaac, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for your for sharing your personal journey and your introducing, at least for me, the notion of the fourth wall. I've heard of the fourth wall in terms of acting. I've never put it together in the analytic space. That might be my limitation. Others may be more familiar with it. But if those who are not, it's a new angle on what we do. It's a new angle. Your phrase, the choreography between internal and external world, I think is lovely. And thank you for sharing it. And thank you for talking to us today. I learned a lot and I enjoyed it.
Thank you for including me, for inviting me.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.